ॐ कथाक्षकिरणाशान्त नमन्मोहार्दये नमः अनन्तानन्दकृष्णाय जगन्मङ्गलमूर्ते स्वरूपम् एव मे सत्त्वम् न तु धर्मो न वस्त्वत् वदन्यस्य सतो भावान् न हि सज्जातिरिष्यते स्वरूपमेव मे ज्ञानम् न तु गुणस्य गुणो यदि अनात्मत्वमसत्त्वम् वा ज्ञेयाज्ञेयत्वयोत्पते स्वरूपमेव मे ज्ञानम् न गुणस्य गुणो यदि अनात्मत्वमसत्त्वम् वा ज्ञेयाज्ञेयत्वयोत्पते अहमेव सुखम् नान्यत् अहमेव सुखम् नान्यत् अन्यच्चेन्नैव सत्तत्सुखम् अन्यच्चेन्नैव तत्सुखम् अमरार्थम् न हि प्रेयः अमरार्थम् न हि प्रेयः मरार्थम् न स्वतः प्रियम् मरार्थम् न स्वतः प्रियम् अहमेव सुखम् नान्यत् अहमेव सुखम् नान्यत् अन्यच्चेन्नैव तत्सुखम् अन्यच्चेन्नैव तत्सुखम् अमदर्थम् न हि प्रेयः अमदर्थम् न हि प्रेयः मदर्थम् न स्वतः प्रियम् मदर्थम् न स्वतः प्रियम् अहम् एव सुखम् सो अहम् अहम् एव सुखम् न अन्यत् अन्यत् चेत् न एव अन्यत् चेत् न एव तत् सुखम् अमदार्थं न हि प्रेयः मदार्थं न स्वतः प्रियम् अहमेव सुखम् I am sukham. Aham eva sukham. I indeed am sukha. In other words, then na anyat, not something else. I am the sukha. Na anyat, not another. Right? Aham eva sukham. Na anyat, all in the nominatives. I am the sukha. Na anyat. Not something else, not another. Anyat chet eva. Eva, indeed. Indeed, anyat chait. Chait means if. Anyat chait, Eva. Indeed, if it was another. If it is another. Anyat, if another. Okay? Indeed, if another. Anyat chait, Eva. Na, sorry. Anyat chait, na, Eva. I think I looked at the na last time. Anyat chait, na eva. Everybody see that?
Mm-hmm.
Anyachet na eva. If anyachet, if another, na eva tet sukham, that is not sukham. Then it isn't sukham. We'll take this line by line and unfold it, but let's just get it for now. Okay? So, if anyat, anyachet, then na eva tat sukham, that indeed, that is not, that can't be sukham, that is not sukha, ananda. Sukha means ananda, happiness. I am the sukha, I am the fullness, I am the happiness, I am the, sometimes sukha is translated as bliss, which is a little misleading, but I alone am the sukha, it's like I alone am the ananda. Take sukham as ananda, of the satchit ananda. I alone am the ananda, not something else. If it's something else, if it's anyat, if it's something else, then that isn't sukha. Then that, it's like saying that can't be sukha if it's something else. Why? Amadartam, if it nahi priyaha, he hears because. Madartam means if it's for me. Artam, for my sake. Mad means me. Madartam has the sense of the fourth case. if it is for me, if it is for my sake. But if you have amadaratam, the unnegates. So amadaratam, he na priyaha, because if it's not for me, amadaratam, the unnegates, then na priyaha, it is not dear. Priyaha means dear. It's not dear to me. Because if it's not for me, then if it's not, because if it's not for me, it's na priyaha, it's not dear. It's not something I'm attached to. Right? If it's not for me, then I don't get any joy out of that. Right? So if it's not for me, then it doesn't mean anything to me. It's not dear to me. Madartam, if it is for me, na swataha priyam, then if it is for me, madartam, now it's positive, arta is for, madartam, if it's for me, then na swataha priyam, it's not dear of its own, in its own right. It's only dear if it's meant for me. But if it's, you know, if it's not meant for me, then na priya, it's not dear. But if it's meant for me, then it becomes dear. Right? It becomes dear. But it's na swataha priyam. It's not dear in and of itself. It's only dear if it's meant for me. Okay? That means itself isn't going to have the sukha. Okay, so that's good. Everybody's kind of see the Sanskrit? Swataha means it's reflexive. Swataha priyam means the dearness, being dear, is na swataha, doesn't belong to it. It's not dear in its own right, right? If it's dear because it's for my sake, then it becomes dear. Then the dear being dear doesn't belong to it.
What? Say that again.
If it's dear, say it says in the previous line, if the sukham, this happiness, right, if the happiness is not meant for me, like say for instance I see somebody else who's happy.
Yeah, like Martina or somebody.
Okay. I watch some happiness on TV, you know. But that happiness, if it's amadartam, it has nothing to do with me. I'm seeing a happy situation, but it has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
Then it's not priyaha. No. It's not something I'm attached to. It's not dear to me. I'm seeing that happiness over here, over there, you know. But that's not dear to me unless, I mean, you can make scenarios where I see my child who is so happy, and the child is dear to me, so then their happiness becomes dear to me.
Yeah.
But if I'm seeing the happiness of another that I have no relationship with, then I'm seeing that they are happy, but their happiness is not something that I want. It's not dear to me. I want my own happiness, right? I see their happiness, I can wish them well and all of that, and be glad that they're happy, all of that. But their happiness is not my happiness.
Right? Yeah, I want ownership of that.
I want it to be able to say, I am happy.
But I think, which level are you talking about, that level of mitya right now? Because I am that happiness. So.
But that happiness is what we, that's the first sign. So let me unfold it.
Okay.
Because unless you have a little feeling for what the verse says, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't unfolded it to really see it. Okay. So, how does it start? I alone am the ananda. When I say I am the I alone, aham eva sukha, I am the ananda. Not anything else. It means it's not a guna, it's not something that I can gain from the outside, like there's the ananda over there, you know? No, I have to be the ananda. So there's not a subject-object experience of ananda. You have to think about this. There is a subject-object experience between me as the jiva, the antakarana, the mind, the knower, and the object of happiness. Like if I say, oh, I have a desire. I want this. I want this. Remember the desire template? Is I want this so that I can be happy. That's why I want it. Now, when I say have, and also in the negative, I don't want this. Why? So that I can be happy. I need this thing to be removed so that I can be happy. Or I need to gain this thing, either an object, a person, a situation, whatever it is. Why do I need it? Why do I want it? Not so that I'll be unhappy. I want it so that I will be happy. So, this is samsara in a nutshell. What it means is that I have superimposed the experience of happiness onto the object. And so what I believe is that if I can attain this object, if I can gain this object, then I will become happy. So what I'm doing is superimposing the happiness on the object or the situation, and then I need to gain it so that I will become happy. Now, when I say that, I'm saying that the happiness and the object have become one. There's a superimposition there. I need the object in order to be happy. If I gain the object, I will be happy. So there's a definite relationship between the object and the happiness. In Vedanta, we have broken this all apart, so we don't really feel that way anymore. Even if we're acting that way, we know what's really going on. But if you're samsari, you haven't figured this out yet, most likely. Most likely you don't even think about it. All you know is that I need to fulfill this desire so that I can be happy. So there's a superposition between the object of desire and the happiness. But in Vedanta we know that what is really happening there in the desire template is that, in fact, when I go through the struggle, say I have a conviction, a desire for a given object, which is other than me, the object, of course, is other than me. I go through the struggle of attaining that, whatever is involved in attaining that. And if I successfully attain the object of desire, at that moment, my mind is released from desire. At that moment. Because say I really want this, and then I get it, now I am fulfilled. I am, for the moment, desireless. When the mind has that momentary experience of desirelessness, that is a shantavritti. That's a shantavritti, because at that time the mind doesn't want anything, because it's just fulfilled itself. And so it has a moment of shanti, of peace. And in that moment, it enjoys the stature of the clear, silent water bucket reflecting the sun, right? Instead, as opposed to an agitated water bucket or a muddy water bucket, at that time, the mind is totally clear, quiet, and peaceful, like a very clear, clean water bucket, how the sun just reverberates through the water, down through the depths of the water. The water is brilliant with the sunlight. And like that, when my mind has that moment of shanti, which is brought about by the fulfillment of a desire, the ananda, my being, reflects off of that mind in such a way that there is the experience of ananda, like a clear mirroring of my being at that time. It's a little different than mirroring, because, like, for instance, if you think of the sun reflecting in the water, there's two things that are happening there. One is the sun is by its swarupa illumining the water, right? Warming the water, illumining the water. So, and that's going to be true whether the water is agitated or muddy or clear, right? That will be true. So the sun actually is the constant, which is illumining, warming, whatever the nature of the sun is, the weather and all that. It's illumining, warming all the different types of water, muddy, agitated, or clear. But in terms of the water itself, okay, the muddy water doesn't enjoy any type of resonance or reflection with the sun. Right? The agitated water has more. Then we can say this is deep depression, really muddy water. There's not even any sun there. It doesn't reflect, and so you feel like death. It's a deep person who's deeply depressed has no desire to live. You know, it's like they're totally, their experience is so overwhelmingly removed from their own presence. that it's like it's just a total feeling of darkness, even though that total mucky darkness is illumined by me, right? But the darkness is so non-resonant, that experience is so non-resonant with my own being, that that person feels totally despondent and isolated and dark. Agitated, agitated water, you can call that an agitated depressant or a manic depressive state. Kind of, you know, where they're totally exalted, you know, like a manic like a manic state, not the manic side of a manic depressive, or agitated depression would be more on this side. Kind of a manic-y state where I'm there, but this like, whoa, you know. So there, but still, that state also, where there's kind of an can be like a manic-y exaltation. That manic-y exaltation belongs to the mind, not to the sun that's illumining that water. Not to me, right? It's the state of the mind that is reflecting me or resonating with me in a particular way. Okay? Because the sun, going back to that drishtanta, the sun hasn't become manic-y. The sun hasn't become depressed. Its swarupa, its nature in all three states is exactly the same. But now when you take the clear water bucket, the reflection of the sun has a semblance to the sun. Right? It's not the same, but it has a semblance to the sun. The water is playing a big part there. But there's a resonance. And there's an experience of an ananda that actually is different than the experience of the sun's ananda, because the sun's ananda is constant. It's there as it is without becoming manic-y or depressed or peaceful. But that still mind has fullness, joy, the variegated states of bliss in it because of the depth of its silence, you know, and its own clarity. So when your mind fulfills a desire, what happens is that the mind becomes very clear, very quiet. For a moment, it is desireless. You have no idea what's happening. All you know is that you've, for an Ajnani, all you know is you've fulfilled this desire and I've become happy because of it. And you expect to do that. And it works. That's why the ignorance is universal. And it also is logical. Right? I fulfill the desire. You know, there's a connection between the fulfilling of a desire and my happiness. So I have this desire. Let me fulfill that desire. Let me get that thing. And then I will be happy. So that's what I know, and that's what is kind of the gasoline that makes life run.
Yeah, you do it again. Yeah.
And again and again and again. Oh, another desire, let me fulfill that. But this is the maya, and this is kind of the Achilles heel that creates a mumukshu, is that it is true that whenever you fulfill a desire, you gain and experience a burst of happiness because of the shanta vritti. But then you realize over and over and over until finally you can't ignore it. It's been realized it too many times, you know, and it's over for you. You realize that this is not working.
Yeah.
Because the shanta vritti you don't even think shanta vritti, you think, I was so happy, but it only lasted for a moment, and another desire arose, which then made the mind, the same agitation came up, and that the desire that arises only, you know, sometimes 15 seconds or 15 minutes, very quickly, you know. And it can even be a desire that this happiness or that this object or this situation should remain. And as soon as you say, this should remain, I need to hang on to this. And then, of course, the instant you think that, all of the possible obstructions that will come to take it away from you come to mind. You know, it's endless. So you just find that the shanta vritti changes almost right away. And you're left with the object but not with the ananda. So we say it kind of just drips off, just it's gone. The object's there and But the happiness that you had worked for is not. Okay, so that's the illusion that is universal. And at some point you'll say, where really is that happiness? I thought it was in that would give it to me. But it only gave me a glimpse and then it went away. I want that happiness. Now the next step to realize is that when, because of the Shantavritti, you do have the experience, I am happy. That is the experience. I am happy. The experience is not, look at the happiness over there. Like, say if I have, I got the object. Look at it. See how happy it is? I say, see how happy this is? You know, is that what I want? No. You say, this object is making me happy. Because of this object, I am happy. Not that I have the happiness as the object. I have the object which has made me happy. You see what I mean? It's a huge difference. So here it says, aham eva sukham. I am the happiness. It doesn't belong, not anyat. It doesn't belong to something else. So you fulfill the desire, you have the object, and there you have the object which is happy. And you're not happy? No. I am the happiness, and that is my experience. I'm so happy. It doesn't, the ananda doesn't belong to any object, to anything else. Na anya. In English, we just, I am the ananda, not anything else. Okay. He says, if anyat chait, if it was something else, then na eva tat sukham. That is not the sukham. That is not the ananda. That is not my ananda. Mm. You know, if it belongs to something else, then it belongs to something else. Mm. We see that all the, oh, look at, Swamiji will usually make fun of this and say, those people are so happy. Those people are so happy.
Sadly sad.
Why do they get to be happy? What about me? What about my happiness?
Yeah.
Other people can be happy.
Yeah.
Look at those people who are happy. Look at that person who is so happy. I don't get to be happy. So there can actually... So he, of course, with Swamiji, you know, he does that really well. You'll really act that up. I want the happiness. And this is the terrible plight of the samsari, because for the samsari, there has been no differentiation between the stable ananda of your being and a vritti, and an experience. No differentiation whatsoever. And so you're not able to when you have a dukkha vritti, sorrowful vritti, or a neutral vritti, or other myriad types of thought modifications that are out there, the only ones that you relate to, the only ones that have a semblance of happiness for you, are the ananda vrittis, because the ananda vrittis that come really from the fulfillment of a desire, drugs, walking in the park, going out into nature, the smile of a child. There's so many different things in life that we know will bring about some type of shantavritti, which will allow us to say, I am happy. And the reason it allows us to say it is because that vritti, shantavritti, resonates with my own being. Even though the sukha vritti is not me exactly, because the sukha vritti comes and goes, and I don't. The ananda that is me doesn't come and go. It is present no matter what type of vritti is there. But when I have a sukha vritti, that vritti, like the clear water, reflects me in a particular way that resonates with my nature, you know, so that I can say, I am happy, happier, happiest, absolutely blissed out. I have so many different words for these different modifications of happiness, all of them based on the shanta vritti. But the shanta vritti resonates with me, and so I love to have it, right? And so for samsari, our state, our happiness, definitely comes and goes, because it is only in relationship to these sukhavrittis, you know, these mental modifications that have shanti in them, that are peaceful. Those are what I call moments, my moments of happiness. And I could ask you, you know, if you go back through your life, remember those moments when you were really happy, and you really, some of them will stand out. Oh, I remember at this particular time, and I remember at this particular time, those times where I really had a deep, profound experience of happiness and well-being. Mm. And then I could say, and remember, if you don't mind, remember the times when you weren't happy. Oh, yes, there were this time and this time. This happened and this happened, and this desire was not fulfilled, and I remember being so unhappy. I was unhappy, and a lot of times I'm just neutral. Everything's fine. A lot of sudden, then there was this handful of times, really, when I was deeply happy. All only in relationship to the vritti, right? And the vrittis, the thought modifications, are not standing on their own. The thought modifications are in relationship to your desires. You know? Like, say, I'm going to take, even these kind of desires, I'm going to take a walk in nature. Why? Why are you taking a walk in nature? Because when I go into nature, the beauty of it makes me so happy. Wow. Just the beauty of it. And so I'm going to go. And then you go. And unfortunately, there's, in your favorite place to go, there's a lot of construction being done at that moment, you know? And so instead of the sukha vritti that the nature usually provides you, now there's a vritti of irritation, you know? Irritation and upsetness. So I'm saying, but you had thought, you know, that it would make you happy, because you're used to it making you happy. Same thing with any type of object that usually has a function of fulfilling a desire, fulfilling you. You know, you do that over and over again because you expect, even though it doesn't always perform, but you expect it to make you happy. But you're expecting it to make you happy, mm-hmm. not really even knowing that what's happening is it is creating a shantavritti in you. And that shantavritti, you know, is resonant with your being, and so therefore the mind experiences happiness. Now, a mumukshu, as you're being taught and you see this, you know, do you understand these dynamics? You'll still say, I want that, because I want the shantavritti that it gives me. I want the shantavritti that it gives me so that I can have some relief in my mind.
The new iPad.
Which I do have. So, you know, but you know what's going on.
Yeah.
You know what's going on, but you opt for it just for the relief of it, you know? So that's just one stage, but at least you know what's going on. There actually comes a time in the assimilation of your knowledge, as your knowledge assimilates itself through the depths of your mind, which includes all of the kind of tenacious desires and complexes and just all of the different levels of ajnana in the mind. Mm. Knowledge slowly works its way through until more and more it becomes for you your choice. It's as though at first it's like a choice, and then it's not even a choice because the problem doesn't come up. But for at some point it becomes a choice that, yes, you would like that, but then you see it's not working out, and then you just, oh, that's okay. Why? Because it's just simply not worth it for you to give up the natural shanti of the mind. It's not worth it to get upset over this or that or the other thing. And even though you have a desire for it, even a jnani, a mahatma, someone like Swamiji who's totally mature in their assimilation of their knowledge, you still have raga dvesha, likes and dislikes. But those likes and dislikes are not, they're what we call dugda bija. They're burnt seeds. Dugda means burnt, PPP, past participle. Bija means a seed. A seed which is burnt. a burnt seed can't fructify into anything. And so here, say, like Swamiji will use the example, you know, of the two sadhus going to Madras, a Madras restaurant, and one's from, you know, North India and one's for South, and the South Indian Swamiji orders the, you know, the idli. The South Indian and the North Indian order some chapatis. The waitress gets them mixed up. You know, so Swamiji gets stuck with the chapatis and the North Indian gets the idlis. Neither one of them would have chosen that. But they're not going to get very upset about it. I say they won't get upset at all about it. They might objectively say, do you want to switch? What if he says, you know, over to the next day, you got my idlis, do you want, and I got your chapatis, do you want to switch? And the guy says, no, it's okay. Sadhu says, and what if Swamiji were to say, well, I'd really, those are my idlis. But chances are very great that neither one of them would care. Because it isn't, well, okay, chapatis, I'll have chapatis this time. It's not a non-issue, not going to make an issue. Any issue that will take away your shanti. That's why when Swamiji will always talk about being objective. Being objective means you got the chapati instead of the idli. If you want to trade, you can be objectively say, do you want to trade? I've got your chapatis. And he says no. Then okay. Are you going to get into a fight over the... You see, it's that what would come... that. For somebody like Swamiji, of course, the idea of getting into a fight over it wouldn't even come. It wouldn't even rise. It's just, well, that's fine. He might not even rise to even say anything. What if he sees the other guy starting to eat the idlis? Is he going to say something? No, he's already eating the... Don't eat the idlis! It's not going to happen. But say they're both looking at each other. Do you want to trade? Yeah, I want to trade here. You know? Fine, that's objective, though. That is objective. It's not worth the any agitation. More and more your mind is like that. Because it's just not worth the agitation, because you're really less and less and less and less dependent on the world being a particular way for your ananda. Because in reality, you're not dependent at all. Zero. Not at all, because the source of ananda is the Atma. There is no other source. You are tricked into thinking there's another source because the fulfillment of a desire creates a shantavritti. That is the trick. And you only know the different types of vrittis, and I like shantavrittis as opposed to agitated vrittis. And you are agitating me, so I don't like you and I want to get rid of you. But in fact, what is agitating you is your relationship to that person or thing. That's what's agitating you. Because the source of the ananda has nothing to do with anything in the object, in the world. You are the source of ananda. And so the mind more and more comes into a position as it knows that, it slowly owns it up until it never doesn't own it up. You know? And any type of ripple, why should I have a ripple? Why should I have to experience a ripple when I'm the source? And so if ripples come, the mind will say, no, I'm not giving up. Mm-hmm. The mind says, I'm not giving up my own, you know, shanti to get all miffed out of shape over this. It's not worth it to me. And then after some time, the mind doesn't even think about that. It doesn't have to go through that process. So you can notice, you know, as you mature in your knowledge, and it's a process that takes place over time. This is what we call pratibandhaka jnanam. There's a certain obstructions to your knowledge, and the obstructions really are not obstructions to your knowledge. You know, but the mind hasn't totally assimilated, because it has had beginningless lifetimes of taking the ananda to belong to the object. And slowly that type of ignorant behavior drops off, you know, over time. until you're not at, you're not even asking the world to do that. And then when you, as you're not asking the world to be the source of Ananda, which it never has been, then more and more you appreciate the world as Ishvara. Why? Because you're not asking it to give you anything. So you're just experiencing it as Ishvara. Again, this is why Rudram is so valuable. Because with Rudram, it's for the Karma Yoga Buddhi. You're continually pranaming to all of the variety of experiences, good and bad. You are Ishvara. This is Ishvara. You are Ishvara. You are Ishvara. You are Ishvara. And it brings about, you know, a relative shanti to the mind. So relaxing the mind by that Ishvara arpitam. Ishvara arpita buddhi means the mind which really is pranaming to the universe is Ishvara. You know. Because, and more and more you, in doing all of that and with your knowledge, you realize that your ananda and your being is not at stake. You're not at stake. And so why should I get miffed about this or that? It's like the graham cracker story.
Yeah. Animal cracker.
The animal crackers, yeah. And all the children want this animal cracker or that animal cracker. An older child just give me the graham cracker, it's fine. It doesn't need to be a giraffe. It doesn't just give me the graham cracker. Anything's fine. It doesn't matter. Okay. So here, I am the sukha, not anything else. It says, if it were something else, then that's for me, that's not sukha. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so something over there. You know? That's not sukha, it's an object, right? So what does that have to do? So he says, why is it not? Well, because, you know, if it's not for me, if that sukha is not for me, then it's not priya, it's not dear. I don't want it. Can you imagine not wanting sukha? Can you imagine not wanting ananda? It's what the whole universe is seeking, right? And so if it's not for me and I see it, you know, then it's not dear. And then he says, if it is for me over there, if it is, then of its own accord, it's not dear. It only becomes dear if it's for me, right? But if it's not for me, then it's not dear. If it's for me, then it's dear. Then it has nothing to do with the object. There's no sukha in the object. You know, like say for instance, you know, you have a desire. And for you, that object is dear. Because you believe it will make you happy. But if somebody else gets that object, that thing is no longer dear. In fact, it's bringing about animosity. There's no sukha in it whatsoever. So the sukha is something that's either projected on the object or not. In fact, the object can make you very unhappy. You think that you want it. Somebody else gets it, or there's some obstruction, and so the desire isn't fulfilled. The sukha just drips right off that object, and it becomes an object that brings about dukkha. Any object, when it's going your way, the object is giving you sukha. When you don't want it anymore, it's neutral. Or if somebody takes it away from you, it's dukkha. So sukha, dukkha, neutral, all three are fluctuating through any given object. The sukha doesn't belong to the object at all. And also your experience is never of an objectified sukha. The experience is of a desire fulfilled, which gives me sukha. My experience is, I am the sukha. I've never had an experience of objectified sukha. Of my objectified sukha.
Say that again.
I've never had an experience of objectified sukha where I am differentiated from the sukha. If it's objectified sukha, then that's not my sukha. I want it. Mm-hmm. Objectified sukha is a projection of sukha onto the object. And then I'm as though without the sukha. Then I have to get that. And then if I get it, what happens is I become the sukha. Always it's I am the sukha.
Yeah, that's the merger you want. I mean, you want that.
But there is not even a merger. You don't experience a merger. There's no superimposition in your experience of sukha. Right? It's always, I am happiness, right? But now we have to make a differentiation, and we have to go and to make the differentiation between the source of happiness and the changing vritti.
Mm.
There is a difference between the source of happiness and a sukha vritti. Say if you say a dukkha vritti and a sukha vritti, sorrowful vritti and a sukha vritti. Both come and go, right? You have a sukha vritti, it comes and it goes. Does ananda come and go? Not the ananda which is myself. and the ananda which is myself is aparoksha. It means it's self-evident. The only thing is, I have not differentiated the self-evident wholeness of myself from the variety of vrittis that are experienced, some of which are sukha vrittis, some are dukkha vrittis. So actually, a good meditation, too, that can be juxtaposed side by side. One meditation where you're reflecting on moments of happiness or when you've fulfilled the desire, and so that you're generating in your mind a sukha vritti based upon, you know, positive experiences that have happened to you. And so now you've created a sukha vritti in your mind. And then you try to differentiate between the ananda of your being and the ananda of the sukha vritti. Because now the sukha vritti, if I start thinking of a bad event that brings about a dukkha vritti, the ananda of your being is not going to waver. But the ananda of the sukha vritti will change into sorrow. So the happiness of the sukha vritti will change into dukkha. But the ananda of your being doesn't change at all. And that is moksha. That is freedom. The freedom is not in gaining more sukha vrittis. That's a secondary result, actually. That's a secondary gain, is that your mind does calm down because it knows the source of ananda is not away from itself, and so it enjoys much more shanti. Naturally, because it doesn't have to go and work the world in order to gain, to produce these dukkha vrittis, sukha vrittis by fulfilling desire. So it has tremendous relief in recognizing that the source of ananda is never away from it. It is me and it is stable. So the mind does change. That's true. But that itself isn't moksha, where you're saying, oh, look, I'm able to generate more sukha vrittis than dukkha vrittis. Well, that's all secondary and it's still some sorrow. You know? The freedom is recognizing that my being is ananda, and nobody, including me, can ever do anything about it. Not even Ishwar can do anything about it. Nobody can. Because that is the non-dual, timeless, changeless truth. I am the non-dual, timeless, changeless truth, which is anantananda. Anantananda means an ananda, a wholeness by my very nature, which is limitless, changeless, one without a second.
Do you have to be convinced about that, or do you just see that the truth? How does that happen?
You can be convinced in that it upholds logically, but you have to be convinced about something that you've recognized. Otherwise, it's paroksha jnana. Paroksha jnana means the shruti tells me that I am limitless ananda, and I have shraddha in the shruti, and it makes sense.
But
that's not knowledge.
Yeah, but the conviction comes from being in touch or seeing awareness, and it convinces you that it's fullness, or...
The conviction comes in the recognition of the nature of myself, in the actual differentiation and recognition, where you say something like, that's what is meant by ananda. When they say, I am ananda, this is what is meant. And that's not indirect. That's recognition. And then the recognition that, and it never changes. That's a recognition of a fact.
Yeah.
And then, when that's also in terms of logic, that's the pratignya. You have the recognition of what the Shastra is saying. The pratignya is the first... In a logical syllogism, the first statement is called the pratignya.
Can you call it, would the translation be premise? I was wondering this last week.
It's like the first premise, it's the initial statement, the first premise. I don't know what they call that in logic.
Premise.
The first premise.
The first premise. I don't know if it's specific.
But it's the first premise off of which the inference is made, right? You're making an inference based upon the initial statement. So what if the initial statement is true or false, right? The initial statement needs to be something which is generated by a valid pramana, means of knowledge. Say the first statement, the initial statement, is just your imagination. There's nothing to validate the first statement. Then any inference that comes off of the first statement is false. But if the Vedanta, if the pramana, you know, gives you the recognition of something which is there, you know, to be seen in terms of the differentiation of your being from mitya, the satyam from the mitya, then any amount of experience, that seeing can withstand any amount of what we call anubhava, any amount of experience, and any amount of yukti. Yukti means logic, you know, but anubhava and logic, experience and logic can't get you to that, right? Because experience and logic are based upon your sense perception. In the world, experience and logic, all those initial statements always go back to pratyeksha, to sense perception. Even though you can have inference upon inference, it's going to go back to the initial statement, which will be sense perception. And sense perception can't take you outside of the box. You're not a sense perception. You're the self of the whole box. Right? You're not an object to be seen. And so that teaching methodology is necessary to take you to the recognition, not to give you the experience of something that's not there, but to point out, to help you differentiate the changeless timelessness of your and nature of your own being, which has been superimposed upon all experience that you have. And it's superimposed because of a beginningless ignorance. But once it's pointed out, then you see it. You know, you see what you've always seen, but you've always seen it in a superimposed condition.
So is the key here to see where the origin of this wholeness is?
Yes, that's one of the things, is you recognize the changeless limitlessness of the ananda, which is your being. And you see its relationship to all of the vrittis that come and go.
Mm-hmm. So this is an interesting technique that you mentioned before about using your own imagination to generate a certain kind of mindset.
Yeah.
And then differentiating.
Yeah.
Are you still
here? Your own presence, yeah.
Yeah.
From that mindset.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can do it throughout your day.
But I suppose you can do it the positive and the negative.
Yes.
If you're not too chicken.
Yeah, and you can do them side by side, too.
Yeah.
And you can do it throughout the day, also. Like, say, all the different types of experiences you have throughout the day, the different type of affects that you're having, the emotional states that you're having, you can say, well, let me see if I'm still there.
Yeah.
Let me see if I'm still here in the midst of this particular experience. And you get used to making the differentiation until the differentiation is just the constant.
Right, but I mean actually doing it on purpose, within your own imagination,
you can
to do it that way, too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, wait a minute, that's one meditation. What's the second one?
You can do them all at one time, where in one half of the meditation you're generating a sukha vritti by remembering positive things, you know.
Or it could be just imagination, right?
Yeah, fantasy. That's what I mean, fantasy. Yeah, yeah, could fantasize something to bring about a sukha vritti.
Or use memories.
Yeah, or use memories, and then you can fantasize something to bring about a dukkha vritti, all of the while recognizing the substrate being that doesn't change at all, the ananda or the wholeness of yourself. Like, say if you can differentiate it in a sukha vritti, and then you have a dukkha vritti, you see, that has the ananda that you've differentiated in the sukha vritti, has it gone when there's a dukkha vritti?
Yeah.
And you'll see, no, it hasn't. And as the mind recognizes that truth, it starts also to relax.
Yeah.
And in terms of, you know, the gestalt, the foreground, background, that your being comes into the foreground from the standpoint of the mind. Because it is, in fact, always in the foreground for one who recognizes it. In the foreground in the sense that, like, if I have a clay pot, what's in the foreground, clay or pot? for a clay pot and yoni, the pot is clay. So the clay is totally into the foreground. Not that the pot is into the background, but the clayness of the pot is not hidden from you at all. And the focus is not on the pot to the extent of covering the clay. So the clay isn't covered. So here your being, what I mean by it's coming to the foreground, it's not like the Namarupa's kind of fade away into the background. It's that your being is approach is totally pervasive and present to your experience. It's not hidden in any way. Yeah. Let's stop here.
That was great.
That was like talks on Sukha. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.